Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest.
Hello, I'm Richard Walker. Welcome to Network Europe. Coming up, after Poland dredges up the war to gain sway in the EU, we go to Warsaw and the Polish-German border to see if the Kaczynski brothers are in touch with the mood of the people. And as if the EU wasn't in the news enough already, they go and produce this. Yes, Brussels tries to sex up its image with sex. Ingenious. Doping in the Tour de France. Will the sport ever recover from this seemingly endless scandal? We also stop off in Berlin for our weekly postcard. This week, ich bin ein Berliner, but only if I'm nice, apparently. All of this and our monthly competition, this time with a twist, coming up on Network Europe, a partnership of Europe's leading broadcasters, today coming to you from Hilversum in the Netherlands. Poland joined the EU 3 years ago and has been gaining an ever-widening reputation as a diplomatic bruiser. Their tactics at the latest EU summit drew fierce criticism from across the continent. The already raised eyebrows of liberals have risen further up their foreheads this week. Luxembourg's Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker said it was very near to unacceptable, while others called Poland's President and Prime Minister Kaczynski twin brothers Germanophobic. Poland wants to use a system that gives more power to smaller member states. The current system gives more voting power to larger nations, making the Union's most populous state, Germany, the most powerful. The sting in the tail was President Kaczynski's suggestion that if the Nazis hadn't killed so many Poles in World War II, they would now be the most populous nation in Europe and therefore the most powerful. But does this row reflect the way ordinary Poles feel? Deutsche Welle's Harvey Graupner went to the German-Polish border for Network Europe to find out.
The somewhat poisoned relationship between the Polish and German governments could easily have triggered a revival of decades-old prejudices and stereotypes among large sections of both populations. But in a border region spanning the towns of Frankfurt and Oder in Germany and Słubice in Poland, there's been little evidence that top-level irritations have had a trickle-down effect on ordinary citizens. On the German side of the border, people don't seem to have taken much notice of the recent political quarrels.
It does not have an impact on the personal relations. We get together and have fun and have other contacts, and I think it didn't suffer here.
The older people may be influenced from their backgrounds, from history and so on, but I think there's no problem between these countries in my view. It's only a problem of politics.
Of course there are stereotypes. Even we are making fun for each other, no? Saying, well, you're stealing our bikes and our cars, and yeah, but it's fun, so we make it on a fun level. But I'm sure that if you move further into Germany, that the stereotypes have more impact, because they don't know so many Polish people, and here in the border region you meet them and you talk to them and you have much more contact, and you know they are not all the same.
In a marketplace on the other side of the border, Polish vendors and German shoppers are engaging in pre-deal small talk as they have done for decades in the past. The Poles living in the region couldn't care less about what's going on at government level, or so it seems.
We are the third generation after the war. For us, it's very abstract. It's a problem of old people like Kaczynski. It's all the time in their mind.
We are two different countries, two different nationalities, and this is always the stereotype between Polish people who are raging against everything and German people who are very in good order. And I guess the only problem is the stereotype.
We feel that there's no relation between politicians and normal people. We cooperate with Germans just fine.
You can also encounter a sense of shame for what's perceived to have been the Polish leader's stubbornness and megalomania at last week's EU summit in Brussels. Most ordinary Poles haven't regretted being new EU members for a single day.
It goes like you give the finger and they will eat the whole hand. I think the government behaves like that because we can travel abroad, we can work abroad, and we've got a lot of money from European Union. We've got really much as members, as a new member.
Surely it's very, very good that we are a member of European Union. It gave us great opportunities.
Historians on both sides agree that current irritations have to be overcome as soon as possible, and speak of good relations between the two neighbours being a historical necessity.
Nothing is ever plain sailing where the relationship between people is concerned, and particularly people who in the past have not exactly seen eye to eye in their relationships.
It's not going to be an easy process, and I don't think anybody believes this is going to be an easy process. There's a sense of reticence on both sides, but I think we will be strong enough on both sides to solve the problems.
Hardy Gropner, Berlin.
Well, one of the voices from that piece said he thought the Polish-German issue was only a problem for older people like President Kaczynski. Is it only an emotive subject for Poles who feel close to World War II? To help me find out, our Network Europe partner in Warsaw, Michael Kubicki, Polish Radio External Services in Warsaw, joins me on the line now. Michael, do you think that's true?
Well, definitely there is this difference between various generations of Poles. I mean, the Kaczynski brothers represent what I would call the middle generation of Poles. Of course, people in their perhaps 60s and 70s have still different views. This is certainly a very good observation. There are several other things that caught my attention in this report. It's interesting that the word that was most often used by those interviewed was stereotype. And I think that indeed Polish-German relations are fraught with stereotypes. Someone else said that high-level politics has no impact on the personal relations between Poles and Germans. The latest public opinion surveys here in Poland confirm this. They say that over 60% of Poles regard the Germans as nice and pleasant people. However, I wouldn't say that the recent political quarrels have gone unnoticed among ordinary citizens here, because in the same survey, 43% of Poles say that they are concerned with this latest deterioration of political relations with Germany. And one in every three Poles supports the performance of the Polish government, claiming that it successfully defends Polish interests. The tone of the debate in the Polish media rather accurately reflects these varying opinions.
And Michael, what are those opinions? How has the Polish media reflected them? Can you give us a sense of the two sides?
Well, I suppose we could say that the Polish analysts and leading commentators represent two camps, as it were. Most of them are hardly surprised that references to World War II and Poland's destruction during the war provoked harsh criticism in Germany. Over the past few days, I talked to several people, so I think it would be of interest to listen to what Jacek Kucharczyk of the Institute of Public Affairs told Polish radio about it.
It is a part of the political correctness within the European Union that you discuss the issue at hand and use substantive arguments referring to the given issue. In this case, the issue was how you organize, how you divide voting power between member states. And you should not use populist and demagogic arguments referring to blaming Germany for the Second World War and so on and so forth. I think that this was completely out of the received norms of conducting European debate.
Michael, that's obviously a reflection of the sort of wider reaction in Europe to this issue coming out of Poland. Do we also have many voices in support of the Kaczynski brothers, President and Prime Minister?
Well, yes, indeed. These are people who would say that, on the one hand, Poland cannot be deprived of its right to recall its history, but there are certain norms of political correctness, and the Kaczynski brothers seem to ignore them. At the other end of the spectrum, there are those who would say, well, for many years after the collapse of communism, Germany acted as an advocate of Poland's entry into the EU. It was, in fact, Warsaw's mentor. And so these people would say, it's not surprising that Berlin find it difficult at the moment to accept the fact that Poland is now its equal partner in the European Union. And hence they say the new type of relationship is kind of a psychological shock for Germany. And I think an opinion of Marek Magierowski, who's deputy editor-in-chief of the Rzeczpospolita daily, illustrates this very well. Magierowski claims that the same line of thinking prevails in most of the Western media.
Poland is one of the six biggest countries of Europe now. But on the other hand, most foreign media consider Poland as a small, insignificant country in the periphery of Europe. And I think that contrast makes foreign journalists think that Poland should not voice its own concerns, should not present its own proposals, be they political or economic.
Well, Michael, I mean, that's one perspective, isn't it? Do you think that that's the motivation for the Kaczynski brothers to bring up the issue of the Second World War? Basically, they feel like you're not taking us seriously and we're going to get your attention whichever way we can.
Well, I suppose that many of their remarks are addressed to their hardcore electorate. But, I mean, in my view, they should not be called anti-German politicians. I think that they can't fail to notice that Angela Merkel is genuinely committed to an improvement of relations with Poland. And I think it's very important that the Polish media gave much prominence to what the German Chancellor said about a need to push over-excitement aside and about the historical necessity of shaping good relations between Poland and Germany as neighbors. I hope we'll be seeing some sort of goodwill gesture from Poland before long.
Okay, thanks a lot, Michael. Michael Kubicki there in Warsaw. You're listening to Network Europe.
Please love me, the sweet food.
There's new evidence to suggest that it's the summer of love in Brussels. European governments often seen as aloof, unrepresentative and meddling. But now, if you go surfing on the EU's website, you'll realise that Brussels is involved in the sexy and seductive world of the movies. Hundreds of thousands of visitors to the site have been enjoying a steamy short film montage of famous sex scenes from celebrated European movies. The two-minute film's now a hit on YouTube, but it's upset a good number of people as well. Vanessa Mock from Radio Netherlands Worldwide told me who's been offended by sex.
Yeah, well, we've had apparently a couple of disgruntled reactions from some Polish MEPs from the more conservative wings of Polish politics about a short promotional video that's been made to promote European film. Now, it's a video that's been put together by the European Commission, and it's fairly graphic. It's kind of the best of EU, of European sex scenes from award-winning directors like Bernardo Bertolucci and Pedro Almodovar. It's fairly steamy stuff. It shows couples getting it on in toilets, on kitchen sinks and in the good old-fashioned bed. But it's very tastefully done, but it does also feature a very short sequence of a gay couple, and apparently that's ruffled some feathers with these Polish MEPs.
Let's hear it. Right, well, Vanessa, we should point out that, you know, this wasn't designed for radio, so it may be a little bit misleading. I mean, they weren't graphic sex scenes. They were sort of, you know, looking at faces only, weren't they? And maybe hands on bedposts. But nonetheless, it still seems to me that the EU has suddenly got hold of the idea that sex sells and the EU is suffering from something of an image problem. So why don't we use sex to get a better image?
Well, I think it's not entirely that. I mean, this is one of four short films that was done to promote the media programme, which is kind of the audiovisual support programme that the EU Commission does. And the Love one, of course, is the one that has had the most hits. In fact, almost 300,000 hits on YouTube.
Just to put it in perspective, what's a normal number of hits for a video that the EU puts on the website?
Well, I think we can safely guess that if it's a little clip about biofuels or car engines or agriculture, then it's not going to be, it's going to stay in the low hundreds.
Right.
Yeah. it's going to stay in the low hundreds. So this is definitely the most successful film that the EU Commission has ever put out. They're arguing it's very good promotion for European cinema. And, you know, damn it, we should be competing against our US rivals. And if we get a bit of publicity, free publicity on YouTube, because we've managed to put together a very stylish and, frankly, quite erotic and steamy little clip together for our viewers, then that's good stuff. And the clip there has got a lot more notoriety ever since a British tabloid started writing about it last weekend. But until that time, it seems that Europeans had interest not in the bedroom, but out of it. Here's what the Commission spokesman Martin Sallmayr told some journalists.
The most watched one was until an article in a British tabloid newspaper this weekend, probably the best promotion that we ever got. But the most watched of these four clips was Friendship, which we see what Europeans really interest until the moment that tabloid newspapers get into it. So we think this is, we can be proud in the European Union to have strong European cinema, to have cinema from all over Europe, films that travel across the borders and then present very strong emotions, which is the typicity of European cinema that you may not find elsewhere in the world.
So there you go. In staunch defence of European cinema, Martin Sallmayr, their commission spokesman.
I think he's being a little bit coy, though, don't you? Because inevitably, when you make a video as steamy as the one that is currently on the EU website, the tabloids are going to pick up on it, and then it'll reach a much wider audience. I'm sure they knew that when they commissioned it.
Yeah, it's a bit of smart marketing, of course, by the European Union. But, you know, normally the European Commission, especially this big lumbering legislative powerhouse of Brussels, is always being attacked for not getting the message through to Europeans, absolutely just failing to connect with the ordinary citizen. For once, it seems they've got it right. For once, they have got a reaction. For once, they have managed to get through their message. And if it's using a slightly underhand way by using sex to get its message across, then, you know, all good luck to them, because at least people are talking about the EU, which is more than what they do if this clip was about agriculture or farming or whatever else.
Not dumbing down to sell the idea that the EU isn't always as dry as dust.
No, I think it's, I don't think it's dumbing down. I don't think it's dumbing down because, well, the European Commission would argue what we're showing here are clips from award-winning films, films that have really been internationally recognised at film festivals in Cannes and Berlin. So these are not cheapo in-house productions. These are good quality films that deserve to get international recognition.
Whatever next? Well, maybe you can suggest something. Each month on Network Europe, we have a quiz question which you can usually get right by typing it into Google and forwarding us the result, but not this month. This month, I'd like you to suggest how the EU could improve its image and connect better with Europeans. The sex video's been done, obviously, but I think you could put the Brussels spin doctors to shame. So in 30 words or less, please send me your suggestions to contact@networkeurope.org. It could even be in the form of a poem. I'll read out the best ones in 3 weeks' time, and who knows, with all the influential people who listen to Network Europe, your idea could soon be turning heads in the corridors of Brussels power. The Tour de France pushes off in London this week, a city notorious for its intolerance of anything on two wheels, and the public's enthusiasm for the race has dwindled over the past few years, thanks largely to scandals of competitors being caught taking performance-enhancing drugs. The American Floyd Landis was crowned King Yellow Jersey last year, but officially Landis is no longer the winner of the 2006 Tour de France. He failed the drugs test. Radio France International's Hannah Godfrey explains how, with Landis's help, the wheels have come off the tour.
When does sport cease to be sport? Last month, an independent report confirmed findings made by the anti-doping lab at Châtenay-Malabry that one of Landis's samples taken at Morzine after his impressive comeback on the 17th stage contained abnormally high levels of testosterone. The results of the tests have been challenged by Landis. Last November, the French anti-doping agency lodged a complaint that hackers had breached the lab's computers and stolen data. The French sporting paper L'Equipe claims to have evidence from a police source that the hacker was allegedly part of Landis's team. There's currently a press blackout at Châtenay-Malabry. The French anti-doping agency, an umbrella organisation, says it wants to protect the lab's employees. It seems that members of staff have received physical threats, and there's been a threat that the lab would be set on fire. Could routine doping controls have led to this? Dr. Jean-Pierre Fouliot, who works for the French government's doping prevention mission, explains how these controls are carried out.
The controls start made from urine, and these controls can be done in competition at the arrival.
But some performance-enhancing drugs like EPO can be taken a week before tests and not be picked up, yet will still be having an effect during the competition. Experienced dopers know exactly when to take the chemicals, in what quantities and combinations, to avoid falling foul of the doping rules. Cyclists seem to have an unusually high number of skin problems and allergies. The corticoids prescribed to treat these conditions mask the presence of prescribed doping products when samples are taken. And what are the range of products that cyclists use to enhance their performance? Dr. Michel Guinot looks after cyclist healthcare for the French Cycling Federation.
I don't know, but I think I have some indications that they take all the drugs they can use. It depends for
all
what
the drugs they can get hold of.
They can find in the forbidden list. It depends for what It depends on the circumstances. Some kinds of drugs are to improve aerobic performance. So it's to increase the performance during the competition. But you have to recover after competition, and other drugs are used.
So how widespread is the doping problem? Dr. Fouliot again.
To the question, is it doping in sport? Yes, there is. And there will be doping for many, many years. It will be a continuous fight. But to the question, are top athletes all using doping? No.
But the problem may get worse before it gets better. And it seems that some prefer to attack their judges rather than practice a bit of soul searching. I'm Hannah Godfrey.
And from cycling in France, we head north with no connection whatsoever to Sweden, where for the first time a court has decided that a girl or woman can be granted asylum if she can prove she's at risk of being forced into an arranged marriage abroad. A 15-year-old girl has won her case, and lawyers say it could open the way for many other similar claims. But is Sweden really a haven for girls facing forced arranged marriages? For Network Europe, Radio Sweden's Tom McAllenden finds out.
Oh, roligt, Mickey. Glad. Inte stressad.
Paula Bemmerbrut telling Swedish Radio how happy she is to be granted asylum here. She says she's no longer stressed and will carry on with her education and get her Swedish passport. Her lawyer, Johan Hedberg, explained why she came to Sweden as a 12-year-old from Tunisia.
She was supposed to marry a 7-year-older cousin. And she didn't want that. It was arranged already when she was 12 years old that she was supposed to marry this guy. Paula didn't love him and she didn't want that, so she flew and asked for asylum in Sweden.
So what did the immigration authorities originally decide?
They said no. They said that Paula should return to Tunisia because, firstly, they didn't believe her. They didn't believe that she had to go through this forced marriage. Secondly, if that was the case, they said, it didn't come up to persecution, which is necessary according to the Geneva Convention.
So how did you argue that it was persecution?
There is a ground in Sweden that say that if you have a well-founded fear to be persecuted because of your sex, then there is a possibility to get asylum status. We argued for the court that if a girl that is 14 years old is to be in an arranged marriage, she is definitely a refugee, and the court agreed with us on that one.
The immigration authorities have already tried to appeal the decision, but a higher court said it won't hear the case. Johan Hedberg says the ruling will be of great interest to other girls around the world in a similar situation.
If you can prove that you are in fear of getting into a forced marriage, you are entitled to asylum in Sweden.
Is that just for children or for older people too?
That's an interesting question. That hasn't been, as far as I understand, when I read the verdict, they don't talk about, is this only for children or can this be applied even for adults? And that has to be tried in another case, I reckon.
But while it might sound like great news for those fleeing forced marriages, there's been criticism of Sweden's laws here when it comes to girls and boys facing the same fate here. Well, as you might expect, it's illegal for Swedes to be forced into marriage. It is allowed according to the law if it forms part of someone's background or traditional culture. Discrimination, pure and simple, many say, and now there are calls for that exception to the rule to be scrapped, as well as the law which means social services are obliged to involve the parents of under-18s, even when the problem is the parents. Zubeda Demirash Sayad from Stockholm says she was tricked into an arranged marriage as a teenager, and it took her 16 years to get out of it. Now she works with desperate young girls in the capital who are facing the same thing.
Youngsters who come to us, that it's very emergency, you know, it have happened something, often something more than the normal life they have go through. Because if you look, these girls have many years behind them, there they have been maybe psychology, physical beaten, but maybe they have been fell in love with a boy, and they maybe had sex, and they have lose their virginity. That can be the reason that why they come to us, because now if it comes out to my family, it can be life and death questions, you know. So they must maybe escape as fast as they can. Or it can be that the girls know that now it's summertime, like now. Many girls take to the countries and gonna be married with somebody. And they know because they have heard that when the family have talked with some relatives. Or girls who are going to take to the country and be könsstympad.
They're circumcised.
Yes, and they know that. So, you know, it's often a hard reason for them to come when they come to this emergency case.
Zubeda's currently working with 25 girls and says during the summer buy and sell months, in what she calls a meat market, teenagers from Sweden are seen as a much coveted prize.
Of course, when you are from Sweden, you are more worth, because you're going to save a person's life by getting him to Sweden, and then you started to work here to send money to his family. So you support all his family. And many families, when they come and ask for a girl's hand from these European countries, their prices are much higher. Because when the boy's family come to the girl's family have always the right to ask what they want from that family. And sometimes I have heard all the stories, you know, there they want 100, 200, 300 thousand crowns on the girl's bank account, or the family wanted a house or a car, or many families sell all the properties they have. They go and take bank loans because they know this is an investment. Even if I must go and take a big bank loan, I know that in the end that this money is going to come back to me.
Honor-related culture has started to hit the headlines in Sweden over the past 8 years or so, most notably after two women were killed by relatives for falling in love with the wrong men. But nobody really knows how widespread the problem of forced marriages in Sweden is. Zubeda thinks the government needs to have a rethink about how it takes care of those who give up everything to avoid them, and says apart from the physical protection offered, there's a black hole in support available.
People say, you know, you live in Sweden, you know, sometimes the girls feel very angry and frustrated, because it's very easy for a Swedish person to say that. Of course, I'm not stupid. I know that, the girls say. But do you know what kind of price I must pay to take the decision? And what can the Swedish society offer me if I leave all my group, my identity, my everything? And there we have the biggest problem. Today, I'm very scared to say to the girls, leave your families. Actually, I never say that. I'm very careful to even show them a picture after they have left their family, which are very good, because we have not that picture. It's only a picture. It's not reality. The government must put more resources, you know.
Resources
to the time after they have left their families.
Tom McAllenden with that report from the Swedish capital, bringing us close to the end of the programme, but not before a new regular item on the programme, a brief postcard snapshot from one of Network Europe's producers. This week, Deutsche Welle's Leah McDonnell is in the famously rude Berlin, where it seems being nice is suddenly all the rage.
Berliners are getting nicer. The no smiling in the street law seems to have been lifted. Bus drivers no longer gleefully pull away from the curb when they see you running for it. Tough-looking old ladies on their bikes no longer try to hit you, or at least not as much, if you dare commit the grievous crime of traveling the wrong way on the bike path. There seems to be a growing tendency to make eye contact with strangers, and shopkeepers have learned how to be human beings and no longer bark at you for wishing to make a purchase. Yes, I thought, serious progress in civility is going on here, no doubt about it. But just to be certain I wasn't the only one who has noted a change in Berliners' treatment of their fellow man, I asked others around town about their urban etiquette observations. And with the exception of some incurably negative hardcore Berliners who would find a reason to complain if they'd just won the lottery, most had also noticed a vast improvement to the quality of social rapport. A while back, when bus drivers growling and snapping at passengers was bordering on abuse, and too many public complaints were filed, the city actually sent its bus drivers to politeness training. They, of course, rallied against it, claiming it encroached on their personal freedom. Maybe that's where this niceness trend began. Or perhaps it can be more attributed to the large influx of foreigners that have made Berliners realize that being pleasant isn't a sign of weakness or a horrible imposition, but simply makes the day a bit brighter.
And as always, if you'd like to listen to this or any of our programs again, you can by logging on to our new website at www.networkeurope.org. You'll find information there on how you can subscribe to our podcast even. Now, we'll have to get feedback on our programmes from our listeners. You can send your comments, suggestions, ideas, criticisms, and don't forget the less than 30 words suggestion for how the EU could promote itself better to our email address, contact@networkeurope.org. That's just about all from me, Richard Walker, here in Hilversum in Holland. This programme is a partnership of Radio Netherlands Worldwide, Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague, Radio Ukraine, and Radio Slovenia.
Je suis fou.